Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and Douglas J. Cohen is here. Hi, Douglas. How are you?
Hey, Donald. Good to see you.
Good to see you. We've been conversing by email back and forth for many, many weeks because you are on to talk about two different projects. You are here to talk about your brand new book called How to Survive a Killer Musical, Agony and Ecstasy on the Road to Broadway, as well as the new cast recording for the musical The Big Time, which you co-wrote with Douglas Carter Bean, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, but we're going to start with the book, which is all about the creation and the productions of the musical No Way to Treat a Lady, which is a story in itself. And as I read the book, because I was emailing you in various places as I was reading through the book, and letting you know my thoughts as I read it, as we will get to, there's one specific section of the book that I just sat there going, you know, you could make a movie just out of this one section of the book. Which,
I'm so curious to know which section that is.
We'll get to that. But anyway, because a lot of people, when you bring up No Way to Treat a Lady, the musical, people always say, and you mentioned this many times in the book, people go, oh my God, I love that show. Even though a lot of people are like, have never seen it. They've never seen a production of it, but they've heard the cast recording and they love the score. But it's one of those shows that everybody's like, well, I love the score, but I've never seen a production of it. And I would love to see a show. So let's go back to the very...
Also, people have never heard of the show.
Yeah, or people have never heard of the show. Or they've heard people mention it, but they're like, I've heard about that show.
Right. They knew there was a movie and they thought they knew that someone adapted it.
Right. Yeah. So talk about the very, very beginning, because it goes all the way back to 1985. And it starts with a load of laundry.
Yeah. It's one of those things that just was happenstance. I don't love doing laundry, so I try and distract myself. And while I was waiting for it to finish in the wash cycle, I just happened to turn on my TV, and it was a small little black and white television, because I had just moved to New York and, I didn't have a color TV set, but it didn't matter. I must have turned it on just seconds after the movie started, because I remember seeing Steiger as the priest paying a visit, a social call. And I was immediately transfixed. First of all, his performance is riveting, but the whole premise of the movie was really intriguing, that there was this frustrated actor who was unable to get headlines as a performer. So he figured out a way to become a media sensation. It was kind of ahead of its time. You know, he was a social media maniac. And he did so by entering various women's dwellings, women that reminded him of his mother, that's a whole lot of fire, and would pay them this social call and fulfill in many ways their dreams, their expectations. They're very lonely people that needed this attention. Unfortunately, for them, it ended with their demise. But for him, it kind of propelled him into this, you know, supernova career as a serial killer. And the idea that the man who's assigned to the case is his brother's a doctor, his detective, Morris Brummel, a Jewish cop who lives with his mother and shares this mother fixation with the killer, and kind of understands where he's coming from, that they share the symbiotic relationship. It seemed like really interesting, fertile ground. And that's when also I saw Lee Remick. And, you know, as soon as you see an amazing character like Kate Palmer, which became Sarah Stone, because in the book, that's her name, and played by this beguiling, beautiful woman, it just added a whole other dimension, because she becomes the third part in this kind of menage a trois. And so immediately I just thought, Eureka, this is my next musical.
You then have to figure out how to get the rights. And William Goldman had written the original book. So you just decide to reach out to Goldman.
Well, yes. I mean, this was, again, very fortuitous. I have to say that there were so many auspicious things that happened in the first leg of the journey that I had every reason to believe that the Hudson Guild production was going to be a great hit and that end of chapter. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So many things that just aligned beautifully. And I was later to find out that was really misleading. However, I was very, very lucky. I didn't even have a reference book. I had to call my parents to find out who had written the original book on which it was based. And it was William Goldman, who I just happened to know peripherally because he came to see the only other show I'd ever had in New York. It was the very first show I wrote, co-wrote, called This Week in the Suburbs. It was in the Inner Circle, which no longer exists, on Jane Street. And he and his wife, Eileen at the time, happened to know Terry Berenger, one of the cast members.
Mm-hmm.
They came to support her. And I knew he was coming. And I was reading Adventures in the Screen Trade, so I was all prepared. I had the book with me. And we had a great chat. And it was the only night the show went well. I describe in the book what happened. There was a reason it went well that night. And he was delighted with what he saw. So when I found out it was William Goldman who had written the novel, No Way to Treat a Lady, I assumed this is going to be a slam dunk. And I did find his name in the phone book.
Yes, this is pre-internet. So yeah. it's you know, you got to look people up in the phone book. I mean, this doesn't happen.
It doesn't. And, you know, just think about it for a second. There were famous people like William Goldman listed in the phone book with their address, with their phone number.
Right.
It says something about this country that we were not faced with a problem with stalkers.
Right.
You know, because I'm sure he never got those calls, those people that, I mean, first of all, William Goldman was an author, so I guess that's a little different from being.
He wasn't, right, but he was, I mean, he also was an Oscar-winning screenwriter. I mean, he was very well known, yeah.
Yes, and Marathon Man, and Princess Bride, and, you know, I mean, he had a career in every medium, including theater, but less successful in theater. But he did write the definitive book at that time on theater called The Season. So anyway, he was in the phone book, and I decided I wasn't going to call him, I was going to write him. This was more strategic.
Mm-hmm.
Since I already knew him, or at least he had seen my work, I figured this was the perfect way to introduce the subject of this musicalization. And I wrote the letter. It was a good letter, and waited and waited, and crickets.
Mm-hmm.
So I just took upon myself, I think 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, to call him because I had the phone number.
Mm-hmm.
And he answered, and he said, "Oh, yes, I got your letter, and that's a really, I didn't know what to say because it's such a strange idea for a show, for a musical." And he was coming from how the tone of his book,
right,
which I later was to discover, it wasn't easy to find. I had to go through New York Public Library. And then my dad, you'll see in the book, there's a little note that he sent me, which we scanned for the book. And he had Xeroxed the entire book and sent it. Because you couldn't even find, I mean, there's no internet, so where was I going to copy? I could hold on to my copy from the New York Public Library and pay extraordinary fines, but, you know, he made it easy for me. So anyway, the book is very, very dark. I don't know if you've ever read it.
I have never read the book, no.
Oh, it's, I have to tell you, Donald, that I felt ill. I mean, I really actually felt ill. There were things in it that just really disturbed me. But I already had this wonderful film in my mind. And the tone of that film had inspired me while I was watching the movie to write four songs that later made it into the original production. So I already knew that flavor, but the book kind of took me in a different direction. So I understood what he was thinking, and I said, "I know, but if you could only listen to what I've come up with, I think I can change your mind." And he said, "Okay, what are you doing tonight?" And it was already 3:00. So I guess I made time for him, and he came over, and I played him the songs, and he was fascinated by them. But he did not say, "Great, let's keep going." He said, "I can't tell you can't write this, but I would like to discourage you to focus on your own projects." But as I say in the book, I'm 25 years old. I edit out what they hear.
Right.
To me, that was like, you know, keep going, Doug, and see you in the fall, and let's see where your progress has taken you. So that's what I did. And I don't know if you want me to talk about that very decisive moment.
Yeah. The things do kind of eventually start to come together, because talk a little bit, I want to move a little bit to BMI and ASCAP, because, you know, listeners may not really understand the role that those two things play in the development of shows. So kind of give the listeners just kind of a brief overview of what BMI and ASCAP workshops are like and how important they can be in getting shows up. And then ultimately what happened with you for the show.
Right. Not only getting shows up, but just learning your craft.
Right.
You know, we think we know what we're doing, and then we really don't have any idea. Get to BMI in that first year, and it's sobering, because there's so much talent in the room. So you first of all are very aware of the competition, but you're also aware that you are doing things without craft. It's purely talent that has gotten you to that point. So anyway, BMI is wonderful about really, because of Lehman Engel and his books, and that they really crystallized the process and why an I Want song is so important, and what you have to establish in the first 10 minutes of your show and how you develop these characters. So that was crucial to the development of No Way to Treat a Lady. I have to say, I did not get a lot of favorable responses initially in BMI. Alan Menken did like So Far So Good. He thought it was a lovely song, tune-wise. But it was really hit or miss. And then I got great praise from Ed Kleban on one number that was enough to energize me and make me feel validated. Mm-hmm. We all need that. We really do. I mean, as much as I believed in the show, I really wanted my peers and my teachers to feel that this was a worthwhile venture. So there's BMI, which you have to audition for. There's the ASCAP Musical Theater Workshop, which is conducted very differently, because it's not really about teaching you craft. You don't meet weekly. Mm-hmm. You meet once a month, and you only get to perform your songs twice in that whole semester. So they assign you the night. You have three other projects on that night. And instead of having your peers weigh in along with your teacher, you only have four people on the podium, on the platform, critique your show. And those four people are really well known. They're celebrities in theater. So hearing them weigh in on your songs in a very public place can be very exhilarating, but it also can feel demeaning, and you can leave feeling like, okay, that's it. I'm worthless. And we're talking about people like, you know, Charles Strauss, who was the moderator, Stephen Sondheim, who would be there once in a blue moon, and he was never joined on the dais with anyone other than Charles. But then when he wasn't there, you had three others, and they could be, you know, Sheldon Harnick, Jerry Herman, I think, came once. You know, they had performers like Patti LuPone, Peter Stone, the book writer of 1776. You know, we'd major critics, and one of them was there on my night. And Stephen Schwartz, and, you know, just an incredible, Julie Stein, Martin Charnin, people that were legendary. And so those were the two games in town, really. I mean, I started out putting my toe in the water and going to the 92nd Street Y. Mm-hmm. Because Carol Hall was teaching there, Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. And that was just four classes. And that was really, I'm so glad I did that, because she was a great teacher, and she just made me feel like I could put anything out there and try anything and be fearless. And she was never going to, you know, make me feel inferior. She was very smart and very intuitive. And Carolyn Lee was the other one I took a class with her, and she was also very, very good. So that was it. There was no NYU program. There are a lot of wonderful groups now that meet, and I'm sure they're all very valid. So I was fortunate to get into BMI through my audition, and I was very fortunate to get into ASCAP that year with No Way to Treat a Lady.
Who is it?
Detective Brummel, NYPD. Miss Stone, I'm here regarding your neighbor's murder in 6B.
Of course.
Good God, what eyes. Bluish, greenish, hazel. Loveliest eyes I have ever seen. Well, look at me. Suddenly I'm shaking. Is this passion or too much caffeine?
Is something wrong, Detective?
Brummel. Morris Brummel.
And everybody calls you Mo.
Yeah.
I bet you hate that.
Yeah.
Mo Brummel.
That's me.
Not much on looks. Not much of a dresser. His every move lacks a kind of grace. He's not at all like the guys I've dated. What a perfectly nice change of pace. So far, so good. So far, not bad. He wrote my name and number in his book in pen yet. He's kind of cute. Well, for a cop, he has a certain glow, especially on top. Sense, forget his sense of humor. His charming smile is none of my concern. No matter what, he can't charm this consumer. A business call, that's all it is. And when the questions end, believe me, friend, I'll tell him, go, no, not just yet. Although I should, before things move along too far. So far, so... God, what time is it?
Almost 9:40.
Oh, I've got to go. I've got to be at work at 10 and I'm not dressed.
That's okay. I'll come back when you have more time.
Well, not tonight. A new show opens at the gallery. What about tomorrow night? Maybe we could go out.
Out?
Good. And it's all set. I get home from the gallery at 7:45. I'll need time to look beautiful, so can we meet at 8?
Sure.
Well, see you tomorrow.
Goodbye, Miss Stone.
Sarah.
Goodbye, Sarah.
Goodbye, Mo.
So far, so good. I can't complain. At least I have tomorrow night at 8 to live for. Dear Sarah Stone, don't look so sad. You'll find that Sarah Brummel doesn't sound happy. I may break up. Oh God, my throat is dry. I'll grow so sick with love. With luck, I won't recover. Now what's the use? I'm sure she has a guy. A fiancé, or even worse, a lover. Doomed from the start.
A waste of time.
I've had my fill.
I know the signs.
Don't stand for more abuse.
Use some excuse,
but tell her no. Don't break his heart. I bet it would.
You think it would.
God, it's just a day away.
I'm going out with a cop.
I think I may be sick.
I bet he chickens out.
I have a date tomorrow night. So far, so
good.
So talk about the pivotal, there's a pivotal evening at ASCAP, which is the one that it involves Frank Rich, the critic, but it turns out that you invited Goldman to attend.
Yeah, so William Goldman was still on the fence,
and
I just went ahead and submitted a tape of four songs to ASCAP. And lo and behold, I got in on October 28th, 1985. I will always remember that date. And it was the opening of ASCAP for that year. Mm-hmm. I was the last person. They tell you what order you're in. 1, 2, 3, 4. I was 4. So I called him and said, I got into ASCAP. And he said, I thought I told you not to work on that show. And I said, well, you didn't say not to. You just didn't encouraged me, but you did not say not to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I said, but it would be great if you could be at the presentation. And he said, okay, what date is it? And I told him, and he looked in his book and he said, okay, I'll be there. And, but he said, no one must know. So, I was the fourth that night. The panel was Charles Strauss, Burton Lane, On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, Finian's Rainbow, Stephen Schwartz, we don't have to give credits there, mm-hmm. and Frank Rich, then the leading critic of the New York Times Theater. So I knew at that moment that it was either going to be, you know, a great crowning achievement, or it meant the end of the road. And it was a very good night for me. I mean, I'm not about to say that everything they said was complimentary, but everything they said was encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they said made it feel like this project was valid.
Right.
And Charles Strauss at the end of the night, they all talked about William Goldman too. They said they wanted to know, do you have the right?
Right.
And I didn't know what to say. So I just said, I think I said he's aware of it, mm-hmm. but I didn't say that I was in touch with him or anything like that. And they said, well, we advise you to really pursue this because there are so many stories of people who wrote entire shows and only to have their hearts broken. And that's when Charles Strauss said, and you can tell him that you got a good review from Frank Rich, which mm-hmm. was such a generous thing of him to say.
Right.
But then it was.
It's such an amazing moment in the book because you can't make this stuff up. It's you know, it's one of those scenes where they're telling you all this and they're talking about William Goldman like he's not there. And he's actually sitting in the back of the room witnessing all of this. And of course, I can't even imagine what's going through your brain because you know he's there and they're all talking about him. And all I could think about is why you didn't like. I'm sure you had the urge to turn around and look at him and go, look, see?
Yeah, but I think that I'd have blown his cover. I think I would have blown my chances.
Right, you know, exactly. I
really respect his wishes on that score. But I do feel like there was that moment when I think it was Stephen Schwartz said to me, you know, he's probably in the phone book.
I know you said that. I know, it's in the book. And you're like, I'm sure you were thinking, yeah, I know. I already know that.
And I even remember his number. 1113 with the last four digits.
But that was you know, at that point he was on, right?
There was the turning point. It really was. And you know, knowing Bill Goldman, I don't think it was just because these four people liked it, although I'm sure being a good business person, he sensed that, look, if Frank Rich likes this property, you know, that could be a good investment.
Mm-hmm.
I also just think that I would like to think that I just eventually won him over. He saw Jason Alexander. That was our cast. Jason mm-hmm. Alexander was performing the role of Detective Morris Brummel that night. He was, he'd done Merrily 2 years earlier. He was doing Personals off Broadway. I mean, he was still an up and coming performer. Mary Testa was playing the barfly who sings Still. I think seeing these people, it just, and giving it a context and hearing the audience's response was also a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
That it wasn't just dependent on Frank Rich and Stephen Schwartz. But I think it didn't hurt.
Right.
And then, he said to me at the end of the evening, I went up to him and I said, I'm sorry that, you know, if they said anything that, because they did say something like it's a minor work of his.
Mm. Right.
It's not like that he has to be so possessive of it. He said, no, it's all fine. All good. Call me in the morning. And I took that as a good sign. I mm-hmm. really, I don't think I ever for one moment thought I'm going to call him in the morning. He's going to say, yeah, well, you tried and it didn't work out. So let's just call it a day. I knew that was a good sign. And the way he said it. And anyway, he said, God bless. And he left. And then the next morning we had a nice chat and he told me he wanted my lawyer to get in touch with his lawyer.
So let's jump forward a little bit to the Hudson Guild production, which is sort of where the whole saga of the productions start rolling. So which it starts off with, I mean, first you have Playwrights Horizons kind of circling.
Yeah. Robert Jess Roth, who did Beauty and the Beast, was there that night too. And he was a reader for Ira Weitzman. And he bounded. I mean, Donald, that's the only word I can use to describe. He bounded up to me at the end. And all this energy. And he said, I'm Robert Roth. Robert Roth. I read for Playwrights Horizons and for Ira Weitzman. And I read 90% of everything I read is shit. Mm-hmm. And this is great. I'm so excited by it. I want to know more about it. So I had a really good fan in Rob, and he was constantly telling Ira, you know, giving him updates. And we were really both kind of in our own way, hoping that Ira would say yes. Because we all know that was like the place to go. You know?
Right.
There were other alternatives that were just as valid. Playwrights had such a great track record. And Ira did invite me over, and I played songs, and he asked me to come up with a dance arrangement on the spot, which I somehow miraculously did and could never repeat. So he was always interested, but he didn't make the first move, and that was the Hudson Guild.
Yeah.
West 26th Street.
Right. And it sort of becomes, it becomes a bit of a pattern, and it sort of becomes something that's sort of part of the standard way of doing business in New York theater, I guess. It's this constant thing of, people are circling, but nobody ever wants to make the first move. Or sometimes somebody's interested, but they don't want to make the move. They don't want to make a move unless they know someone else is interested. And it happens all the time. And in this, the saga of No Way to Treat a Lady, it seems to happen multiple times where, you know, one theater group is really interested, but, you know, we're not going to do anything until we know somebody else is interested. And by the time, Jamson does it later on. But in this case, you know, it does land at Hudson Guild, and it becomes the first, which I think is kind of interesting, is that in the course of the history of the show, you end up working with two Tony winning directors who are both very interesting characters in and of themselves. Both provide very colorful stories. In terms of the production history of the show, but who, as crazy and wild as the stories get with them, the one thing I took away from both of those interactions with them was that, if anything, they loved the material and ultimately were doing the best they could and what they thought was the best they could to protect the material. And yes. Protect the vision of the material. And
Madelon, I think.
Yeah, especially the second one, which we'll talk about in a minute. But talk about that. Talk about the experience with Jack Hofsis, who was your first director at Hudson Guild.
Well, Jack was a client of my agent, George Lane. Mm-hmm. That was another nice thing that happened. Another perk as a result of ASCAP was I knew someone at William Morris, and she conveyed the success of that night, and he summoned me almost immediately, and he expressed interest, and then I had to audition some more songs for him, and he said, I'll represent you. George was one of the most powerful agents at the time, and for many decades he continued to be. He was James Lapine's agent on Sunday in the Park and had a great roster of people. I was a minnow in that sea. I really was. But he believed in me, and he believed in the show, and he represented Jack. Jack Hofsis, to many of you who don't know, was the original director of The Elephant Man on Broadway. And that was a huge success. And he won the Tony Award. He was 28 years old, the youngest person to ever achieve that honor as best director. And he had this great, brilliant career. I mean, all of a sudden, you know, he was being beckoned by Hollywood. He did a film with Jill Clayburgh, wasn't particularly successful, but nonetheless, you know, he was on everyone's list. And he was on Fire Island one summer and dove into a swimming pool and broke his neck.
Uh-huh.
He nearly died, and he was revived, but he was a quadriplegic. He had some use of his right arm, I believe, in a limited capacity. And so everything came to a standstill for him, and he went and sought treatment. And I think at one point, Josie Abadie of the Berkshire Theater Festival invited him to direct all, what's the Tadmoiselle piece?
All
something with home in the title and all. I don't remember either. He direct that, and it was a really healing experience for him. And so George said, you know, he's really eager to come back to New York, and I think this is the right show for him. And he showed Jack the material, and Jack and I had a conversation. And it was a very limited conversation. I don't think he was even in New York. I think he was on the West Coast, which is why we spoke by phone. But I remember feeling like I like this guy, but I don't really have a sense of his take on the material and what he would feel is necessary to bring it to the next level. Because It was early work, and I was a young writer. And it was, I overwrite, and it wasn't focused as much as it should have been. So I remember asking him, who do you think is the protagonist? And he said, the killer. I said, why do you think that? And he said, because he's the most interesting character. And so I thought, well, that's honest. I love that. But it shouldn't be Kit. It should be the detective. And this highlights what work I need to do, because if he thinks he's the most interesting, then we've got some problems perhaps. But I didn't really get a real sense of what he would do to rectify that. And so I had other directors that I was talking to, and they were giving me much more impressive responses. And I went with one of them, and only to find out that his agent never communicated the offer. And Jack was told by our producer that he didn't get the job before the other director accepted. So then it meant I didn't have a director.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to kind of grovel a bit. And George helped me on that score. But it really was one of those things where Jack always knew he was the second choice. And yet, to his credit, he never, ever brought it up. He was an incredible guy. I mean, just his gallows humor. He never would say, oh, gee, today I feel exhausted, or, you know, I'm really depressed about my condition. Never transmitted any of those things. His sense of humor, which I cite many times in the book,
mm-hmm.
so acute and kept everyone so entertained that it was really a joyous experience. However, we did the Richard Rodgers reading. I won a Richard Rodgers development grant, and it only outlined and highlighted all the areas that were problematic about the piece. And I had a very short time to make these changes before we went into rehearsal
for
world premiere production. And Jack was not approachable during that time, you know, and he didn't really have much to contribute to the conversation. And I was really scared. He wanted to bring in James Kirkwood,
mm-hmm.
who wrote Coursland and all those great books. I love James Kirkwood's writing. I'd read a few of his novels, and so he was a wonderful writer, but I felt like that was a very kind of, it felt like, wow, aren't there steps that we can take before we call on James Kirkwood? This is an act of desperation. And that's when I suggested bringing Rob Roth into the fold as a dramaturg, mm-hmm. and assistant director. And that turned out to be a very smart move. And Jack, again, very welcoming. Rob, we interviewed him. Rob was on the show the next day. And that really kind of saved me from further humiliation. And a three and a half hour show became a 2 hour, less than 2 hour show, probably an hour and 50 minute show. So that's major work that happened there. In maybe 2 or 3 weeks.
And isn't this also the time when Goldman came in to help you as well, which I thought was really interesting, because it showed how invested he had become in helping with the actual property itself.
Right. Well, all along I was calling him and writing him, and he would always give me advice. He was great that way. He was giving me advice on casting. He said, you know, Paul Newman said, if I'm right for the role, I'm worth every penny, but if I'm not right for the role, I don't know why they're, you know, making such a fuss. And that was very important. So he said, Doug, don't be misled by celebrity. Don't go with someone because they're a name. Go with them because they're right. And that was, you know, not that we had so many names that were, we bandied about a lot of names. We talked about Mandy Patinkin and Kevin Kline and how they would switch roles, you know, and well, they didn't want to work for $175 a week, you know,
it's just,
there's also reality. So that was not the issue, but it was very important to keep that in mind. And then finally I said to him, you know, I'd love for you to see the show. And he said, well, check with your director first. And I did. And Jack said, sure. And he came in 4 days before the New York Times was to be there to review it. So it was close, but I knew we could get something done in that time. And he met me at the stage door afterwards and said, it's good, except for your opening and your ending.
Yeah.
And my heart kind of sank. He said, but let's get to work. And we went to his apartment.
Yeah.
And for maybe 2.5 hours that night. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he gave me.
And you learned that less, the lesson of you have to sometimes kill your babies.
Oh, yeah. Kill your darlings.
And, you have to.
And he was so smart in the way he approached it, because he said, you know, not only do you fix something by eliminating it and only your family and a few friends know it ever existed, but mm-hmm. you fortify the material that remains. And that's so true. It really is. You know, it's just, I used to think, oh, they're going to forgive you if you have, you know, a bad number mm-hmm. Because the other numbers are so good. But it's not true. Don't you feel the same way, Donald, that when you mm-hmm. see a show that's going well and you see a real bump in the road, you have to work three times as hard to get the people back. You know,
yes. Absolutely.
Your audience really does go like, oh, that doesn't feel like we have the same energy now. Mm-hmm. And so I think that he put his finger on the pulse. And one of the ironic things was the song that got me the rights that I did at ASCAP, that was the one that was so well received, Five More Minutes, was the number he wanted me to cut.
Yeah.
And
the smart, I have to give you credit, whether you did it intentionally or not, but the way you present it in the book is because you have so much weighing or invested in Five More Minutes. The reader is very invested in Five More Minutes because we've seen how important it has been to the development and selling the show to begin with, that when you get to that moment where Goldman is saying, you need to cut this song, as you're reading the book, you're like, oh, wait, what? As the reader, you're like, you can't do that.
And it went against everything I'd learned at ASCAP.
Right,
and
exactly.
BMI, because it was Mars Brummel's I Want song. Mm-hmm. And it was actually kind of playing into what Jack initially said, which was the killer is the more interesting character. Mm-hmm. It was going to be, because now Mars didn't have that background that he could bring to the audience, you know,
that
statement, that like, what are my needs? So it was a risky move, but it was like the movie, you know, it intrigued mm-hmm. us. And I have to say that when years later, I did a reading with Raul Esparza, and Joe Calarco was the director. Joe and Raul discussed that number, Five More Minutes, and they felt it would be stronger if we cut it. And we did the reading without it. I can't believe it. But I'm getting ahead of the cart before the course, because Five More Minutes did not exist at that time. It was another number that I wrote that was a superior number that got cut for that reading. So it's interesting that that has always been a dynamic in the development of the show. And to this day, I don't know if we are better served with an opening number for Morris and Kit, or if it's better off just going with what the blueprint of the movie is, started mm-hmm. off with mm-hmm. a priest who takes us by surprise and kills his first victim.
Right. Talk about, because at this point, you get through the Hudson Guild, and, you know, as we all know, if you follow theater, one of these off-Broadway productions, it's the glittering lights of Broadway and moving uptown and the reviews and the interest of the big theater, you know, the Schuberts, the Nederlanders, Drew Jampson, and the allure of Broadway. And sometimes it just doesn't happen. And it becomes the disappointment. How do you handle all that? Because it's always that thing where you're always reaching for, and you kind of sometimes have to settle for the fact that it's just sometimes not there, regardless of how well liked the show is or whatever, things don't always align.
Yes. And actually, I think it's a good time to let your listeners know that I kept journals, faithfully kept journals throughout this whole process. So that's why I'm able to have such good recall, because I wrote about it extensively as it was happening. And so the book is kind of unique, I think, in that it draws from the past, and yet it also has my perspective today looking back at it. And so it has those two, the young Doug, the older Doug. I'm not going to say old, but I'm older, definitely older. And so it's an interesting way of constructing the book, I think. So I have these journals of the opening night and what I was feeling leading up to it, because I found out that we had a few very bad reviews and a few very good reviews, and that we still didn't know about the times. And the weird thing is, I don't know if I really covered this so much in the book, but it's very ironic, is that throughout the whole book of No Way to Treat a Lady, the novel and the movie, Kit Gill is obsessed with getting a great review in the Times. Mm-hmm. Great review being a headline. Mm-hmm. That's what the song Front Page News is all about. So I felt like I was Kit Gill, you know, like, okay, we know what the Daily News thinks. We know what John Simon thinks. We know that Clyde Barnes loved us, but and John Simon definitely didn't. But what's the verdict on the Times? And it was the only review Jeffrey Richards knew ahead of time, the wonderful producer who was our publicist at the time. He knew every review in terms of, is it good? Is it mixed? Is it a pan? He conveyed that to the artistic director of the Hudson Guild, who called me in a very kind of, you know, a dispassionate tone to convey this. Okay, so here's the good ones, here's the bad ones. And I was like, oh, please, can we get a little bit more energized about the good ones? But no. And he said, and we don't know about the Times. So I went into the opening night not knowing what the review would be. And it was a very good personal review for me. It was a rave about Steve Bogardus. It was mixed about the show. But when you hear good things about your own work,
right,
you kind of, it overrides the other, you know, and you think it'll all sort itself out. There's quotes here and there were, but yeah, it didn't transfer. It wasn't enough to get it across the finish line. And the sad thing is, and I still feel so, I kind of mourn this to this day, is that we didn't do a cast album, because with that cast, we should have, you know, it's, you'll never find singers like that again. You know, Liz Calloway and Steve Bogardus, and then Peter Slezger was so endearing, and June Gable just, you know, was incredibly, she was like a chameleon. You wouldn't see her on the cast album, but you could understand what she was doing vocally. Uh-huh. So that didn't happen, and we didn't get a licensing deal, and all those lovely perks that come with the territory, I was kind of, you know, I was upset. I mean, that, it was a letdown, let's put it that way.
Look at me, I'm one of the beautiful people. High in my ivory tower, mistress of all that I see. Look at me, I'm oh so connected, protected by beautiful people. So certain of company by my side. At least they provide me with some place to hide. In my Upper East Side apartment, I am living a life of ease, thanks to one very friendly broker and 260 G's. When I'm not reading Town and Country, I'm exploring the world of Elle. I deplore anything nouveau and adore anything nouvelle. In my latest designer dresses, I am fashionably in the know, and I'm equally stylish wearing black chiffon. Every Saturday night's a party where I play with the social set, and we only drink French champagne till the dawn. the guests, toasting the host, toasting the food, toasting ourselves. Aren't we the most? Well, look at me, I'm one of the beautiful people, surrounded by beautiful people. Why do I feel so alone? Just look at me, who was I deceiving, believing in beautiful people? Soaring was easy with company by my side. Pity that nobody cared what lay inside. But then you came along, quite a sight, I have to confide. With your shirt needing pressing, a stain on your tie, and your left shoe untied. And you reeked of cologne, and I've never known anyone so fond of plaid. But then your jokes made me laugh till I had lost all control. And when you looked in my eyes, you saw straight through to my soul. With just one touch of your hand, I felt so safe and alive. I'll never force you to stay.
It's always a feeling that I'm sure every writer shares, that whether or not you have a hit or you have a miss, you know that after opening night, you have to start again.
Mm-hmm.
Actors, you know, audition for the next job, but they don't have to write the role.
Right.
If they get the role, it's already been written. Writers have to look at a gestation period of at least 3, 4, 5, 6. Now it's more like 7 years. It really is. So that's what I was facing, and I was really I was bummed, for want of a better word. But Jeffrey Richards and I put together a full-page ad for Variety. We had some great quotes, and Richard Hopkins of Florida Studio Theater saw the ad, called George Lane, said, "I want to do the show," and I knew that that meant I could work on it again.
Right.
A wonderful feeling to know, because I knew it wasn't over. And Bill Goldman said to me, "You'll never fix the show in 4 days. We're going to do quick fixes. You need." He also told me that one of the numbers, "Killer on the Line," was a number that should be rewritten, and he was right. So all these things just hadn't had a chance to fully develop, and I felt like, okay, now I have an opportunity.
And I want to leave some things for the readers to find on their own. Let's just say the Florida production had some interesting events happen. As you will read when you read the book, this show suddenly starts to get a reputation for being a little cursed because there's all sorts of things I don't think it's you who says it. I think it's somebody else who says it. It becomes the Macbeth of musicals. Because things seem to happen every time there's a production.
That's a little bit of an overstatement.
It's a little overstatement.
200 productions, and there were two instances that were really. It's interesting. I did see Maureen Silliman, who was in the Coconut Grove production, and I said, I reference the Coconut Grove production in the book, but I don't dwell on it because nothing bad happened. She went, well, you do know that Ruth Williamson got hit in the head by a pipe and got a concussion, right? No. Oh, yeah, she was on a wagon. It was going into the wings, and she hit
him.
She said, but trooper that she was, she just decided, no, I'm gonna perform tonight, and she did. So, but you know what, Donald? There are so many shows which do have, if you have enough productions,
of course, you'll
have a couple of those stories. I think there's one or two in this book that are kind of exceptional.
Yes.
And I don't think too many people can actually say that they had that experience.
Oh yeah. So
those two instances, yeah, I know, we will leave them up to the
reader.
Yeah.
But now we're going to move on to your second Tony-winning director.
Yes.
Vivian Madelon. And the show goes to the UK. Not the West End. But it goes to...
I live in London, but yeah.
Yeah. And this is the section of the book that I would love to see a movie made of, because this is absolute insanity from the get-go. This whole section of the book is nonstop bedlam, and it literally reads like, are you familiar with the Ealing comedies?
I know of them, but I've
yes, not,
I'm
not. It reads like it reads like a screenplay from an Ealing comedy that like Alec Guinness used to make.
Oh well, they didn't, the Lavender like, Hill.
Yeah, and
yeah,
Kind Hearts and Coronets, and yeah, all it's one of those sophisticated dark wry comedies that is just crazy. And the great part, of course, is that you have this young American writer stuck in the middle of this nonsense with this trio of producers who are driven by ego and I don't want to say too much. Let's just say some of them have talent when it comes to theater. Some of them are not necessarily that knowledgeable about theater. They are kind of have their own personal agendas. Yes. And you've got a director who is passionate and who takes some interesting stands. You've yes. got a leading man who absolutely goes off the deep end at one point over something so trivial. I had to go back and reread exactly that whole section to figure out what exactly he went nuts about with you.
I'm still to this day not really certain what
it
happened.
Is. The whole thing is, I swear, you could literally make a screenplay out of that just one section, and it would be hysterical, because it's so nuts.
By the way, there's
so
a detail that I did not include that I found after the book was published.
Oh.
That was also insanity. I can share this because it's not in the book, but it's like the day after our opening night, Kit Gill, spoiler, he dies in his mother's arms, and they were on a platform. And the theater told us and told our producers that because they were on a platform, people in the audience felt that we were making him look like Jesus in the Pietà.
Oh, God.
That he was ascending to heaven. Mm-hmm. That we could not continue with that platform. And the next day, Vivian ordered the platform to be cut in half. So it was instead of a 6-inch platform or a 10-inch platform, it was now a 5-inch platform. And that's the insanity that we were working with, you know, that, I mean, people in the audience were dictating the height of the platform. That's a very small piece of what was.
Right. I mean, you're working outside of London at Leatherhead Theatre Company.
I just love the name Leatherhead.
I know. And it's the people running the theater are a whole set of characters on their own. You've got the producers who are called show people.
Yes.
including a very well-known actor from the West End.
Who was nominated for the Tony.
Who was nominated for a Tony Award at one point. And you've got, like I said, Vivian Madelon, who himself is a character larger than life. And you stuck in the middle. And it's just talk about Vivian a little bit, because he goes all over the place. And at some points you love him. At some points you are frustrated by him as a reader. And at some points, ultimately at the end, when things are falling apart and he's battling the producers and you're trying to keep everybody together, you really kind of you kind of love him at the end, because you realize he's doing everything from his heart and doing everything from a sense of integrity. Yes. And trying to hold the piece, and trying to hold the piece together as best he can. So talk about Vivian.
Well, it's the first time I met him was in his apartment, and just as we were getting to know one another, the phone rang, and he said, "Do you mind if I take it?" And I said, "No, no, please do." And I heard him as he was closing the bedroom door saying, "Yes, I don't know, but everything I've touched in the last 2 years has died." But this does not bode well. But we had this, he wanted some changes. At first I was reluctant to the changes, but then I realized this is a smart man. This is someone who, I mean, he had much more to offer than Jack Hofsis did in terms of input. And he had a very good sense of humor. And you know, when you're away from your home, all your loved ones, all your dear friends, I was living the dream. I was in London. But then after a while, I felt very lonely. You know, I felt very much like I was submitting to Stockholm syndrome at times. Mm-hmm. And my identity was evaporating and my Americanism was going adrift and my sanity at times too. I mean, emotionally, it was a very hard time for me. And I found letters that my mother wrote me since then that really attest to the fact that she was very concerned for me. And I reveal something in the book towards the end that also was of concern. But Vivian was my ally. You know, that was the thing, is that I felt like he was my best friend and he was there to protect me and to protect the work. And we were thick as thieves, but he had disdain for our producers. And he called them on it on the very first day. He said under his breath, but loud enough for one of them to hear, "Amateurs." Mm-hmm. And he based it on the first auditions, which really were, when you think about the fact that they hired a reader and yet they had everyone do monologues. Who does that? Mm-hmm. And that they said, "Oh, we determined that the barfly is not British. She's American." And he didn't have any say in that. It was just one thing after another that he was just, he does not suffer. He did not suffer fools gladly, I'll tell you that. But he was very principled about things, but to the point that he would rather the ship go down than have to make concessions. And that was very hard for me. And I had never been, you know, I'm not saying that my parents had the rosiest marriage in the world. Who amongst us can attest to that? Every relationship is problematic, I suppose. But I never went through a divorce. I never was one of those kids that was from a broken home. And I felt that I was going through a divorce here. There was times when they would not talk to each other without an intermediary. I was often the go-between. And it just kept going into this horrible kind of, point of no return, I think is how I would probably describe it, where this downward spiral. But it was not without its interesting, hysterical moments. I mean, I saw the lunacy in front of me, but it was, and I was, you know, this is my job, was to be this kind of a UN peacekeeper, you know, that mm-hmm. I thought I could right the boat. But after a while, you just see it's something bigger than what you can manage. But yeah, they were, he ended up, I think, shooting himself in the foot, shooting me in the foot, shooting the production in the foot. And ultimately, without giving away, he does something at the end, which, oh my God, he kind of destroyed anything, any vestige that was left of that show. But I was able to walk away from it with four new songs, and three of them still exist. And one of them is the show-stopping number of every production that has ever followed. So I have to say that credit has to go to Vivian for encouraging me to do it, but credit must go to my producers who were insistent I write it, and they were right. I needed to rethink that particular moment in the show. And I always think about them when I see a production, because it gives the show so much momentum in the second act.
Okay, now, listen carefully. Let me do most of the talking. Only respond when my mother speaks to you directly. Oh yeah, and three topics you must never discuss. One, religion. Two, my brother. And three, my profession.
Morris, will you relax? I am confident that I will love your mother and your mother will love me.
Hi, Ma. Let me introduce Sarah.
I hope you like dry chicken.
So nice to meet you, Mrs. Brummel.
It would have been nicer a half hour ago while the chicken still had a chance.
Ma, we were held up in traffic.
Don't tell me about traffic, Morris. A chicken does not know from traffic.
Mrs. Brummel, it's simply amazing.
What?
Well, Morris warned me, but he didn't do it justice.
Sarah, what are you saying?
Mrs. Brummel, do you realize you have the best-kept secret in all of New York? I've never seen such a beautiful home. It's so Jewish.
What?
Oh, God, strike one.
By that I mean that you furnished it in the best taste.
I'd no idea you knew so much of our culture.
I fear my words are a bit off the cuff. But any religion that was good enough for Jesus,
Jesus,
is good enough for me.
Absolutely. So tell me, Sarah, you say that you like the apartment.
What's not to like?
I'll have you know that I furnished it all myself.
I swear you hired a pro. You're quite a talent.
Yes, I know. Fancy designers are pains in the neck. Then in the end, they all hand you such
dreck.
Precisely. Need I tell you more? It seems we've so much in common.
I think as you do. Off.
What?
He's got his foot on your sofa.
It's not your sofa.
Off! I should have known he'd embarrass himself in public.
What public? I live here.
I'm simply shocked at his vulgar and crass display. Show some respect.
I feel exactly the same way.
His frightful manners are equal to none. He fares even worse when compared to a son like Franklin.
Franklin?
Franklin! Strike two.
You must be proud to be blessed with a son like Franklin.
Let me tell you, I am.
Successful doctors are so in demand these days.
He's worth his weight in gold.
When he was born, they broke the mold. And then there's Morris.
I beg you, please stop.
What's more ridiculous than a Jewish cop?
Detective.
Detective.
Ha! Strike three.
Oh, yes, we've so much. So much in common. The perfect union.
I'm overjoyed.
I'm seeing double. And that spells trouble. This scene is enough to frighten Freud.
Oh, what's that heavenly smell coming from your kitchen? I'm dying of suspense.
Collect your taste buds and tell them to follow me. Here, grab a fork, dear. Go on, take a bite.
I've never tasted such perfectly like knedlich.
Knedlich?
What's your secret? Tell.
A teaspoon of salsa.
Stop, I'll die.
Trust me, darling, would I lie? When we have so much in common.
You're quite a mother.
You're quite a catch.
Heartfelt endearment just means that we're meant for each other.
Queen Esther's met her match.
You know we've so much.
So much in common. You're fond of Sarah. Well, so's your son.
Oh, yes, we're so much. So much we are.
We owe much
to my faith that's restored. My hope that's renewed.
It looks like a
a way, she reminds me of me.
A home run.
I don't want to talk too much just because that whole section of the book is such a great read. And like I said,
Noise is off. I have to say that's what it reminded me of a lot.
Yeah.
Noise is off. You know, there were times when the theater felt like it absolutely was conspiring to do us in, which I could never understand because a lot was riding on them too, but they didn't like having visitors and they didn't like having people who were commercial producers who were telling them what to do. And it felt like we were not on the same team. No one was on the same team. I was hopefully on Team Vivian. He was hopefully on Team Doug, but I think that's kind of where it ended. Mm-hmm. At times, Peter Felicia was saying to me recently, so who was your greatest, who was the director that you felt closest to and the one that was your adversary? And I said, well, it was Vivian, both. Mm-hmm. He was both my champion and my adversary. So depending on the day. But I loved him. And I really overall have very good feelings about Vivian, and I hope I've done justice to his talent because it was considerable.
Ben, the life of the show doesn't end in London. I mean, there's an upstate. It could have after that. There's an upstate New York production, which we won't talk about because I want the readers to read about that. But let's just say you end up having to go on as one of the characters in the show, which is quite a fun little story. And then the show continues. Lonnie Price joins the team and you start doing backers auditions. And then you lose Lonnie Price. You lose a theater. You lose some directors.
Yeah.
Again, there's talk of moving to Broadway that doesn't come through. And then things kind of suddenly start moving again, which is it's so interesting that the show keeps getting reborn and keeps bubbling along. And then the Sharon Playhouse in Connecticut with Michael Kirker and Scott Schwartz, they take a crack at the show, which ultimately ends up bringing it to the York Theater.
Yeah, I have to say too, because I, you know, we sometimes read things online, and there was some chat room that was talking about the fact that I was always doggedly pursuing the show and promoting it and whatever. But it had a life of its own. Mm-hmm. I was writing other shows. I had moved on.
Yeah.
And in fact, I have a whole chapter that's about where I use the word Michael Corleone, because I was being pulled back in.
Yeah.
Almost against my will. There were times when I thought, I just can't go through this again. But there was enough of a carrot there that I was encouraged to revisit it, mm-hmm. hoping that this would be the last chapter. And it just kept going. So it really was independent of me, I have to say. It wasn't just my blind faith in the material.
Because the York Theater actually, then, I mean, you end up with the York Theater in New York.
Yeah.
And the Signature Theater in Virginia.
At the same time.
At the same time. And
with the same director.
With Scott Schwartz
was doing double duty.
Yeah. Yeah. And two very different productions.
Oh.
And it's sort of a mixed blessing in some ways, because the York Theater production ultimately generates the cast recording mm-hmm. that we have.
And the licensing
deal, which is great. Then the Signature, if I remember in the timeline correctly, the Signature production opens after that.
That's right.
Which is a little bit darker.
It's
a much darker take, gets great reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And
the Washington Post was a rave.
Yeah, from the Washington Post, which actually, if the York Theater production had never happened, the response to the Signature Theater one could have potentially propelled the Signature Theater one to New York on its own.
Or at least got really attracted the attention of a commercial producer who would have done a commercial production with Scott, so we would have an open run, you know?
Right, exactly. So it was sort of a mixed blessing, I guess. I mean, ultimately, the good thing is that the York Theater production got the licensing deal in place and the cast recording.
And Bruce Kimmel,
right.
I have to give this to Bruce for recording that originally on Verez Saraband. Because as I said in the book, without that recording, there would be no 200 productions. There would be seven. End of story.
Yeah. Well, because that's how people have discovered the show. And exactly. And then the nice thing is that you then talk about some of the real significant productions. As you mentioned earlier, you had the Raul Esparza 2014 reading. You'd also talk about Rob Ruggiero doing Barrington Stage and Hartford Theater Works.
That was a great production.
And then also interesting productions in Germany and Italy.
Yeah.
The Italian one, tell me a little bit about that, because that one sounded really fascinating.
It was like finally seeing the Broadway show that I never saw, you know, that it was mounted in a way that I couldn't almost believe it was No Way to Treat a Lady. There were these, it was a very kind of high-tech, hip take, and yet had a lot of heart, a lot of humor. The scene with the barfly, just prior to Still, the actress invested in it in a way that I could almost imagine Anna Magnani doing that role. It was kind of magical, and what was so beautiful about it was that it was set in the mountains, in this kind of medieval village that faced the water. So the setting was intoxicating, and then to see this beautiful production, of course I couldn't understand a word they were saying, but I knew it was my words pretty much. And lovely orchestrations and that's the thing, Donald, you know, I have to say that we all love our boutique musicals, our chamber musicals, but you know, I don't think any composer can say that they love having chamber accompaniments. You know, we really hear things with more instruments. And when you don't present that, the audience only has their own ears and they can't interpret what we had in mind. So I was given another five musicians. They weren't there live, but they were, it was in Italy, apparently you can just tape these orchestras. But it really gave me the dimension to the score that I'd always been seeking. And it's on a CD, it was recorded. And it's also the only folio of music that I have published on No One Treats Me, ironically. It's called Serial Killer Per Signora. So if people want to look on eBay, sometimes that album comes up. And it's well worth getting, even if you don't know what the words are. I can't, but it's the music, and they're very good performers.
I più delle volte le vittime stavano nella stessa stanza con lui. E non lo sapevano. Pare che colpisca nel pieno della notte, ma non hanno prove, perché le vittime sono tutte morte.
Shh! Hai sentito niente?
No. Perché?
È tutto troppo calmo. Qui? Ma che silenzio che c'è, troppo silenzio per stare con te. Ma non sorprenderti se la quiete non mi riposa, mi rende nervosa. Qui, ora mi mancano i cric del pavimento che scricchiola il tic del rubinetto, il ronzare del fridge, o i miei vicini che giocano a bridge. Vada, non mi preoccupo, no. Però...
Ma che strana situazione, di colpo non ho ispirazione ed io non so trovare l'idea che non ho allora, solo questa volta ancora e poi smetterò. Perché, perché, signore, questo strangolatore ora che so lo butti giù.
E musica!
Decibels!
Tiriamoci su!
Un rumore in più!
Fammi un urlo che treme il parquet o l'intera città!
Che rave che sarà!
La follia ci porti via!
O la follia o la polizia!
Chiudi a chiave, siamo insieme qui!
Cazzo, ma sta un po' attenta!
Scusa, sono inciampata. Dimmi un po', tesoro. Hai preso degli ormoni per colazione questa mattina?
No. Perché?
Beh, mi sembrava che la tua voce avesse subito un improvviso abbassamento.
No, vedi, da quando ho cambiato vita ho come dei
ricordi
improvvisi.
Qui qualche cosina non va, io morirò se non scopro cos'è. E c'è un'urgenza oramai di un controvelo per te e di un goccio per me. Oddio, quella bottiglia dov'è? Cambiate film, troppo è troppo per me. Bevi un sorso, sta calmo però, ti prometto che non strillerò. Resta lì dove sei, dimmi quello che vuoi. Quattro dollari ho, se li vuoi te li do. Ma che forza che...
So that was, yeah, I mean, that's, if we're talking about agony and we're talking about ecstasy, so agony would have to be Leatherhead. There was so much ecstasy in Leatherhead, and there was definite ecstasy in Borgia Verezzi. So I like to think that the book, even though there are a lot of places where you go, oh my God, I can't believe all these dramatic events, there's a lot of joy permeating through the whole story, actually. And I'm very lucky that I'm when I was keeping these journals and I was looking back on these events, that I was able to see it with a perspective that had humor.
Right.
Because humor is what saved me every time. And gratitude.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as the title of your book says, it is how to survive.
Right.
And you have survived, and the show has actually survived because it's still being produced all over the place. And I do want to very briefly mention, again, not giving too much away because I want the readers to experience the book from beginning to end. But the show does end with an epilogue, which is very moving. And I remember I emailed you after I read the epilogue because I told you that I cried, and I did cry at the end of the book. Not in a sad way, but in just a very touching way, because it's a very touching comment about William Goldman and your relationship with him. So I highly recommend the book. It's one of those ones you really want to, you just want to savor and enjoy. And it's also great to add to your collection because, we have so few really good books that are reference books about the making of a musical. And this one is, it's about not only the making of a musical, but the life story of a musical and how things happen over the years. But now we're going to move on to a new musical.
Yes.
That you have been working on.
Newish musical.
It's going to be new to a lot of people because it's got a new cast recording that has just been released called The Big Time, which is on Concord Theatricals. Talk about this show. It has, you have written the score for it, and the book is by Douglas Carter Bean, who I think is one of the most hysterical playwrights out there.
Oh yeah,
I love his work.
Really great too.
So, give the listeners a little quick synopsis as to what the show is about.
Sure. Well, first of all, I just want to say that I met Douglas Carter Bean at ASCAP, at the ASCAP Musical Theater Workshop. He had a show there that he was working on with a collaborator, and so that's how we met. And when I did the gig, another musical years later, he liked it so much and thought the tone of it was really right for a musical that he was envisioning. It was written originally as a screenplay for Oliver Stone.
Oh.
Yes, that Oliver Stone.
Mm-hmm.
Platoon. And it was about these entertainers, second-rate, third-rate entertainers, Tony and Donna Stefaniti, who are mistaken because of their name for Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, that's Steve and Edie, and get on the wrong cruise ship, which is taken over by terrorists. This was back in the early 90s, maybe? Mid 90s, something like that. It was going to be a vehicle, actually. Doug saw it as a vehicle for Liza Minnelli.
Oh, okay.
And Doug always likes to talk about it by saying, well, Oliver Stone wanted more to blood, and I wanted more show tunes. So they had a party of the ways, but he had the screenplay, and he was very determined to make it into a musical. So he showed it to me, and I thought it was a delicious premise. The premise being that when these two entertainers find themselves on this cruise ship, or it now is a NATO peacekeeping vessel, that there are these Cold War, this is from 1962, Russian dissidents on board, communists, who are looking to take over the world. And of course, our heroes are not ones for gunplay, but they are very skilled at entertainment. And they recognize early on that each of the four Russian dissidents has an Achilles heel. And it's their love-hate relationship with Western entertainment. So one of them loves the stand-up comedy. One of them loves jazz. One of them loves choreography, the Fosse moves. And then the leader has a thing for Edie Gourmet. Mm-hmm. He's never seen her. He only has bootleg tapes. So when he hears that she's on board, he wants her to come to his cabin because he wants to teach her a song he's written, which is his new national anthem when he takes over the world. And she realizes he's stolen the tune from Satin Doll. It's really daffy, but it has so much heart. And I love the fact that it's the entertainers who are the heroes, you know, and that they can outwit the enemy by using their art. I think that's very important because art can be transformational. And in this case, it literally is. Mm-hmm. So it's a Valentine to entertainment. And we have a 16-piece big band because they take over the ship's band as well. Mm-hmm. The cruise ship played by Jackie Hoffman, who loves her. She loves her music, especially like the Xavier Cugart kind of mm-hmm. rhythms. So when they... when they start to kind of control her, it's through the song that they start playing, and she's absolutely head over heels in love with the rhythm and becomes powerless.
No, no, please no. Do not play the music of the Americanos. No, no, not the music of the immigrant. It stirs me indeed. The music that people of America love so. But the people who make that music, they love not so much. No!
Don't you come on to me, chicos. I know you boys in the band. I'm low on resistance, so please keep your distance. I'm drawing a line in the sand. And don't mess around with my border. For you are no sorrow and pain. I have a nervous disorder. And I'm border. I'm loco, so loco, so cuckoo. I could live in a clock, a combo of murder, mayhem, and mambo. This bombshell from Brazil is certifiably.
Save your cougat, and you got me under your spell. With one margarita, this coy mamacita becomes the Evita from hell. Well, don't mess around with my border. There is no green card you gain. You'll never survive with a license to drive, except to drive me insane. Ay, 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 ay.
Señorita, dear mamacita, can we make a sound?
Die, 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 die. Don't mess around with my border. Mexico, Cuba, or Spain. You need set the phones, not for scaling my walls. So you better be gone,
August Eric Smoen, who has done Only Murders in the Building 3, the entire season, the orchestrations, is our orchestrator and co-producer of the album. And he did Come From Away as well. And you will not find a more versatile, talented orchestrator working today, I believe, than August. So it's really exciting. And then we have Debbie Gravett, who is just, oh my God, she is this role. You know, she embodies Donna. And Santino Fontana is Tony. And he is, God, we were listening to it last night at the listening party. And we're all saying how much we love his voice. And Will Swenson said, yeah, if you like talent, you know. But Will is on there. And Will is going to surprise everyone because he is such a funny guy. And he's playing one of the communists. And he's the one who loves stand-up comedy and falls in love with Diane Phelan, who plays the Undersecretary Penelope Petrie. She was just on the tour of Cinderella and Into the Woods. So it's a great cast. Bradley Dean sings the song called Born to Be in the Biz, and Bradley is just hitting home runs with it. And I'm just so proud of the people who are on board this ship and this cast recording, as if you couldn't tell.
Ah, Chief, isn't show business wonderful? Just makes you want to be a part of it. And see how it really is an important part of survival. Maybe just as important as what we do. That's why I gotta be a part of it. In some way, I would like to be in show biz. I want to lift the spirits of those feeling low. Pour out my heart to people I don't even know. Get paid in sweat, but damn it, if that sweat don't show. This kid is born to be in the biz. I wanna pull a hamstring and be forced to grin. Put on a leotard like it's a second skin. I'm listing Broadway Baby as my next of kin. This kid is born to be in the biz. To dance a dance, to sing a song. A bad reason for living. This is the world where I belong. Long as I've got the gift that keeps on giving. To chase away the blues or run a race with fame. To proudly state rejection is my middle name. And when my time is up and I must join the line, let it be a chorus line. Then my work will be done, found my place in the sun, so why mourn?
So tell me what it is like to work with Douglas Carter Beane.
Well, he's a very positive person. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very rare to find Doug in a moment of despair. And when he is, he's very good about figuring out how we can find our way out of the moment, you know, or a particular situation. He's also very funny. So, you know, you're always being entertained by him. And he's very inventive. You know, he's also one of these people that never takes anything personally that I can see. He comes up with solutions very quickly. He's not wedded to anything. It's like, okay, whatever, we'll get rid of that. I'll get the better joke. I'll get a better scene, whatever. He reminded me last night that the opening song, which is called Medley of Other People's Hits, he said, you know, I have to hand it to you because when I gave you the script, it just said at the beginning, they have finished this number. And he said, and you went ahead and just wrote this medley. So I felt very inspired by him. And one time we were doing the show in New York for the NIMH Festival, if any of your listeners remember the NIMH Festival. That's where the only time we've done it in New York, and we got a great review in Variety in the New York Times. We were in rehearsal, and Debbie Gravitt said, I just feel like I need another number. I need an 11 o'clock number. And Doug took me aside and said, you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea. Let's try it. Are you up for it? I said, sure. So he wrote this little monologue, and in it was the phrase, you know, I don't recognize this guy. Who is this guy? When she sees how her soon-to-be husband is, or never-to-be husband, depending on how she feels about him that day, is impressing her, finally. I went home and I wrote, who is this guy? And brought it in the next day. And Debbie was really happy. And Doug was really happy. But it was like, that's teamwork. You know, he just figured out what needed to be said. He has a great appreciation for Philadelphia. It's his roots. And this is a duo that comes from Philadelphia. So you'll hear things like Arch Street referenced in that song. Mm-hmm. Actually a video of Debbie singing it that her daughter, Ellie, who's a very talented filmmaker, produced, directed in the park back in February. Now we're only for the first time showing it on YouTube, and Kevin Solak, who was Diesel in West Side Story, embodies the younger Tony in the video. So I've just found that, you know, working with Doug has been relatively free of any headaches. The headaches come from all the other external forces that we all know are visited upon these shows, and those ruts in those bumps in the road, and I just felt determined that this show be preserved as a cast recording, because otherwise no one will ever know about it. And it worked for No Way to Treat a Lady. It definitely gave it an afterlife. And I'm hoping there's an afterlife for this as well.
What do you know? No longer a zero. Who is this guy? Look at him go. My own superhero. Who is this guy? Brawny and brazen and brash is finally doing his part. There may be a groom in this half-god, half-human who find there is room in my heart. Smart as a whip, like Einstein on steroids, who is this guy? Man, I could flip for someone with his daring do. I think I once knew. Saturday night on South Street, eating hoagies and cheesesteaks, having laughs over cheesecakes, and sharing egg creams, and sharing our dreams. Sunday mornings on Art Street, making plans, making music, harmonizing our voices in song, blending like nobody can. Sunday morning on Art Street, me and my man. Out of the blue, he's back like a sequel. I know this guy. Better than new, this guy has no equal, I find. Once Lady Luck cut him down to size, but now she's ready to canonize this lovely guy. I know this guy. We shed hoagies and cheesesteaks and fries and spumoni, like
And have there, I know there was a concert production of mm-hmm. the show. Has there actually been a full production of the show yet? Or was it just a concert production?
So there have been a couple hiccups with this show too. Not mm-hmm. quite as bad as No Way to Treat a Lady, but we did, when August Eric Simone started orchestrating it, just for the heck of it, you know, he just wanted to give people who were part of Broadway orchestras a chance to kind of flex their muscles. They would perform for gratis in a space in the Village, and he gave them 6 charts from this show. And we invited a producer, a commercial producer, who loved it and optioned the show right away, and then did these backers auditions with a full 16-piece orchestra at Pace Downtown. We did this big backers audition, which generated interest. We were hopefully going to go to La Jolla. It was announced on the schedule. And the Friday we did the backers audition, yielded some nice results. That Monday, Lehman Brothers tanked. And we lost the money that we were going to raise. So that did not happen because the economy took a strange turn. Mm-hmm. But we did get to do the Nymph. And then years later, we did the presentation at Princeton, January 30th, 2020.
Oh.
And 4 weeks
later. Again, perfect timing.
Mm-hmm. The world shut down. Mm-hmm. But it was a triumph. It was an absolute triumph. That's the first time Santino had been part of it. Everyone else had pretty much been part of it for the whole duration. You know, Debbie was in it from the very first reading, from the very first demo. Michael McCormick was in it from the beginning, and Jackie, and Raymond Beaucourt was also in it. So there was, Bradley did it. And that was just so great to see, oh, wow, we're in this big regional theater, and it feels like it's a real show, and Doug had done a lot of work on it, and I had written a new song, and Will Swenson was in it again too. And then of course the world shut down, and we just had to deal with that and lost momentum. And then during the shutdown is when I contacted August, and I said, we need to record this. How can we make it possible? And Eric Stern had done the Pace University concerts, and he was so generous. He said, look, I teach at Berkeley and Boston, Berkeley School of Music, but I will give you any time in August, not August, Eric Simone, but any time mm-hmm. in August 2022. To record the song. We chose 2 dates. We went to the studio. We had no rehearsal with the band, but Brian Crook put a great band together, and we had a newcomer with Diane Phelan, and we made it happen in 2 days. And I was of course panicked that somebody was going to come down with COVID.
Right. You
know, that was feeling. But no one did who was performing. There was one person behind the scenes who unfortunately did, but we were very, 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 very lucky.
And it is now out on Concord, which is great. And hopefully, is it up for licensing, or are you hoping that somebody will pick it?
We're hoping for licensing. Yeah.
Okay.
My main objective was to get the show recorded.
Right.
And then we will see, you know, what happens. I mean, there is interest. There's definitely interest, and we'll see what happens. But right now, I just really want to share these songs. I mean it. It's like I put a lot of heart and sweat and tears and all those things into it, and I want to have people have this experience of listening to a new score that they may not be familiar with.
Right. And it's a lot of fun. It's a really fun score to listen to. I mean,
I feel good listening to it.
Yeah.
It's a big joy factor. And I feel like the performers are so on top of their mm-hmm. game. And so it's something that I think we need today. I think we need a feel-good musical. I know we came out on the same day as Sweeney Todd.
Killer musical, well, right? Yes. Well, there are completely opposite sides of the coin.
They sure are.
Because you can listen to Sweeney if you want, or you can listen to Jackie Hoffman absolutely making you roar with laughter. Because I'm not even going to say which track it is, but there is a track that she has all to herself. That yes. That track ended, and I shot you an email saying, "Oh my God, Jackie Hoffman makes me laugh so hard," because I was on the floor listening to her. She I'm so totally glad. Cracked me up. But it's a wonderful listen. And of course, the band is amazing with the orchestration.
I know.
And it's such a great cast. So congratulations on the album. Thank you. And I'm assuming you're working on some other projects.
I am.
If you can divulge anything.
No, I do have a show that I'm working on. I wrote The Evolution of Man with Dan Ellis, which is licensed through Concord and recording through Yellow Dog. And I'm doing a new show with Dan and with Mike Nitri, who is a Broadway producer, but also a very skilled book writer who had a great idea. So we're working on that, and I'm working on another show with another writer, and I'm writing a book.
Oh, great. Fiction.
Yeah, I really like writing. I mean, I like writing in any form, but I have to tell you, you know, it's really hard getting shows on these days, at least for me. And I like the idea of seeing results. A year and a half ago, I was writing a book, and now I see a result, and it's published. And there's a great feeling about sharing your work and knowing that it's not for naught. And we all need an audience, whether it's somebody in a theater or somebody reading at home. We have stories to tell. And if I can tell it through another form, I will certainly pursue that. So it gives me pleasure to write. And I'm just looking for those moments of pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. Again, the book is called How to Survive a Killer Musical, Agony and Ecstasy on the Road to Broadway. And the new album, the studio cast recording of The Big Time, which I highly recommend both. Where can people find you online?
Well, they can certainly locate me through my website, which is douglasjcohen.com.
Perfect.
There's also a website for The Big Time, which is thebigtimemusical.com. And I believe you can reach out to us there. I'm on Instagram, and I'm also on Facebook and places like that. So, but yeah, I'm not great about updating my website, but thebigtimemusical.com has a terrific guy that's the webmaster, Ian Scott McGregor, who was in a production of The Opposite of Sex, the only two productions that another show I wrote. And he's doing a wonderful job. So anyway, just, yeah, look for updates there and just Google my name now and then.
Well, again, thank you so much, Doug, and continued success.
Thank you, Donald. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.